Welcome to another Late Night Live on Radio National with Philip Adams. A little later, where is the conscience of the secular state? A discussion with Professor Geoffrey Bolton, who seems to think that the separation of church and state in our case has gone a little too far and we don't have an ethical structure with which we can fight off things like economic rationalism, that value-free pathology. But first, someone from another secular state, or at least a state founded as a secular state, although it does seem to be increasingly in the thrall of the religious. I speak of Amos Oz, and before I actually say hello to him formally, I want to read you a few words of his, which I think are terrific. The Israelis often read as if obsessed. They read literature in order to pick a fight with the author. They read a novel as if it were a manifesto and often respond to a novel with a leading article in a newspaper arguing with one of the characters. It's a different tradition in the Anglo-Saxon world where the writer is a refined entertainer. With us, he is expected to be an heir of the prophets, whether he wants this role or not. And the expectation is that writers are there to tell us what to do, to tell us where we went wrong. As far as I know, no American president or British prime minister, and dare I say, in brackets, no Australian prime minister, has ever invited a group of novelists in for an immediate urgent consultation after midnight about a major political decision. And yet, Amos Oz, this is not unknown in your country.
Yes, good evening, Phil. I've been through this experience of being invited to a late-night, soul-searching Dostoevsky and tête-à-tête with a couple of prime ministers. They ask you where the nation have gone wrong. They ask you where do we go from here. They give you a drink. They admire your answers, but they ignore them completely, mind you. It would be very unrealistic to expect the present generation of Israeli writers to do any better than the prophets did in changing the minds of the rulers, and they didn't do terribly well either.
Now, Amos is, of course, one of Israel's finest writers. He's the author of the award-winning Black Box, My Michael. Other novels include The Hill of Evil Counsel, Unto Death, and Touch the Water, Touch the Wind. He's written two acclaimed works of non-fiction, The Land in the Land of Israel and The Slopes of Lebanon. His books have been translated at last count into over 22 languages from the Hebrew. And he's here in our Oz to attend the Writers' Festival and promote the release of his latest novel, To Know a Woman. And I also discovered that you're a professor of literature at the Ben Gurion University. Israel loves its authors, loves its writers, and hates them.
Well, it loves to hate them. That's what it is. Sometimes I think the only way to explain the relatively huge sales of fiction in Israel is that people read sometimes buy 10 copies of the same novel for hatred just in order to demolish them, you know. There is no other explanation to that, but literature does matter to the Israelis.
In one of your books, you wandered around the country interviewing a great many of your compatriots who were tended to be on the extreme edges of the political spectrum. Most of them would have cheerfully garrotted you, apparently, and yet you felt curiously at home with them. This is the paradox of being an Israeli.
Yes, I have to say that when I was putting together those interviews with my most vehement political opponents in Israel, I almost liked even that which I couldn't stand. Those people, while saying to me that I ought to be drowned and quartered and hanged and shot at, were nonetheless pouring my coffee, insisting on paying for my coffee, and trying to rescue my soul as if I was a stray member of their own family, which is exactly the way I felt about them.
Do you think the Israeli family would hold together if there was no longer an outside threat, given its volatility, given the exuberance of debate, given the way it seems to always want to tear itself apart on theological and ideological issues?
You know, Winston Churchill may or may not have been right in saying that a conflict had given Britain its finest hour. This may be right of a short conflict. A long, dragging conflict, such as the one we are having with the Arabs for 70 years now, is degenerating. I think if Israel is out of the conflict with the Arabs, it will start to recover. This will be the beginning of noisy normalization. Not an easy one, not a cozy one. There will be a lot of sound and fury, but this will be the beginning of recovery.
So the family would hold together?
It would hold. I think it would recover.
You are older than Israel.
By far.
Yeah.
I was born as a native under the British. The first English words I ever learned to say were, yes, no, and British, go home, which is what I shouted when I threw stones at the British patrols in Jerusalem in the Jewish version of the Intifada 45 years ago, 40 years ago.
So, Amos, you don't remember a time of tranquility, do you?
No, I don't really.
Was there a moment after Camp David when things...
There was a moment of euphoria. There was a moment of hope. There was not really a moment of peace and quiet.
What happens to the psyche of a nation and indeed of the individual when you're under the sort of pressure forever, basically, in terms of human experience?
I suppose basically the same thing that must have been happening to poor Salman Rushdie since a death verdict was issued on him by the Islamic leaders. Israel has been pretty much in a condition of a collective Salman Rushdie for 70 years now. There has been a death verdict on Israel by Islamic fundamentalists and Arab politicians. Now, this doesn't help your mental health, and it would have driven even the most sane nation insane, and we have never been the most sane nation.
You see an incident at traffic lights with a couple of cars in Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. Instantly, there's a mm-hmm. major drama, isn't mm-hmm. there? The volatility.
Yeah.
People snap quickly. They have short fuses.
Well, look, that's partly the Mediterranean character of the country. Don't forget that. The Jews are essentially a Mediterranean people, very temperamental. We are more out of a Fellini film than out of an Ingmar Bergman film. We are not in the business of putting out long faces and long silences. We fight and scream and shout, and maybe it's not unhealthy.
What is a Jew? Now, I cannot tell you how often I've been asked this over the years by people phoning into radio programs or writing letters, and it's desperately difficult to explain. Are you a non-religious Jew? How do you define it?
Okay, an anti-Semite would never have the slightest difficulty in answering this one. An Orthodox Jew has no difficulty in answering this one. The government of Israel has a huge difficulties in constituting who is a Jew in the eyes of the law. As far as I'm concerned, it's fairly simple. Every human being in this world who is mad enough to call himself or herself a Jew is a Jew by definition. That's good enough for me. That's all it takes.
It's a very elegant definition, but it's not the religious mm-hmm. definition, as you've said. What is the standing definition of the state? I know you were saying how much this has been.
For the purposes of the Israeli law of return, which, as you may know, enables every Jew to automatically become an Israeli citizen if he so wishes, there is no bureaucratic definition. It's being born to a Jewish mother or converted to Judaism according to the decree of the Minister of Interior, often overruled by the Supreme Court of Justice in Israel. And if this sounds very complicated it is, I'm sorry.
Mm. You're one of the most outspoken leaders of Israel's Peace Now movement, and you've got a reputation as the liberal and progressive conscience of modern Israel. It's a fairly heavy burden to bear, isn't it? But you're not a pacifist in any sense, are you?
Oh, far from it. I've been on the battlefield twice in my life, in 67 and 73. I'm very sad to have been there, but I don't regret it. If my country faced an existential threat, a death threat tomorrow, I'd fight tomorrow and fight like a devil. But I draw a very distinct line. I'd only fight for life and for freedom. Nothing else, national interests, resources, or the want of extra two bedrooms for the nation would not make me fight ever.
Mm. You fought in two wars. When you were a kid, you joined a kibbutz. What, at about the age of 14?
15, yes.
15. And you've lived in a kibbutz almost all
for
ever since?
For about 30 years, yes.
There were health reasons, too, apparently, for that.
There were health reasons for my family and myself moving out of the kibbutz about 5 years ago. My son developed a very bad asthma, and his doctors decreed that he needed a different air, so we had to move. Otherwise, I'd still be a kibbutznik to this very day.
Coming back to us mentioning that the next discussion we're having in the program later is on Australia as a secular state, and this is a nation of profound agnosticism. Mm-hmm. While the normal number of people profess religions on the census form and tick Church of England or what have you, it is in fact a remarkably secular society. Mm-hmm. Your nation began as a secular state, but it has in fact been hijacked by religious zeal, has it not?
Hijacked is a bit too strong a word. We have an over-influential little religious parties. They control about 16% of the electorate. Never beyond that. But being the balance, or holding the balance between right and left, between hawks and doves in Israel, they have a political leverage way beyond their actual measure in the population.
But it comes out of the voting system, doesn't it, Amos, this preferential system that you
have? It comes out of the fact that the Israelis have not yet decided to establish their identity, who they really are.
Now, that's an extraordinary thing, because here's a nation born on a on a religious belief going back thousands of years, on the principles of Zionism, and yet it doesn't know what it is.
No, it was born out of despair and persecution. It was born out of a sense of homelessness. And it brought together people who have very little else together. People who came from highly sophisticated countries and from medieval countries.
Yeah.
People who came from dozens of different background traditions.
The Black Jews of Ethiopia,
who were recently airlifted to Israel by the tens of the thousands speaking about Zionism and racism.
And who practice a form of Judaism which has been almost forgotten in the
West. Yes, so if there is a common denominator, or apart from the hatred of others and the persecution by others, this common denominator is a certain set of sensibilities which I can identify but cannot define.
Mm.
I can identify a Jewish sensibility. Mostly sensibilities...
You embody it, though, don't you?
Who am I to answer that? But I can identify one. I can tell a Jew when I see one, even if this Jew is a committed Catholic, or even if this Jew happens to be a devoted Muslim.
Are you serious about that?
Absolutely, absolutely. I can tell a Jew metaphysically. Not racially. It's not in the face. It's not the color of the skin. There is no Jewish race. I mean, all you have to do is to spend 3 seconds in a street in Israel and establish once and for all that there is no Jewish race. It's a nonsense. There is no genetic stock. They come in all brands and colors. But there is a certain set of sensibilities which I recognize as Jewish, wherever I find it.
Let me go back to your own sensibility and to war. You were changed by the Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Well, this Israeli invasion of Lebanon was, to quote Prime Minister Begin, then Prime Minister, an optional war. We could have fought it, we could have avoided it. He said it was a good bargain, which turned out to be a mistake. But even if he were right, even if this war was enormously beneficial to the country in any way, I would still regard this as a moral abomination. If a war is optional, don't fight it.
Hmm. Okay, that's an attitude, but what did it do to you and in you?
Well, it made me skeptical, more skeptical than I've ever been, critical, and yes, it made me a sadder human being. I used to share the cheer, the enthusiasm, the glee of the Zionist enterprise, and now I share it with a grain of salt or with a grain of sadness. There is a difference there. There is a certain lost virginity about Zionism since Lebanon.
Yeah, you call, in fact, for negotiations with Palestinians, but you have a deep and abiding detestation of the PLO.
Absolutely. I think we ought to talk to the PLO not because they are nice and not because they are the victims and not because they are the good guys in the conflict, but precisely because they happen to be our enemies. Now, if you are very lucky, you may have the privilege of choosing your friends. No one can afford to choose an enemy. If I could choose an enemy, I'd probably choose someone else. The PLO happens to represent our most deadly enemies, and it is with those enemies that we have to accommodate. And I think the accommodation has to be based on mutual recognition. And I believe self-determination is not only bestowed upon nice and well-behaved people. It's not some sort of a decoration for good behavior. The Palestinians ought to have their own self-determination, not because they are nice or right or victimized, but simply because they are there.
You said of the Lebanon that Israel died in the Lebanon. Can it be reborn in negotiations for peace?
I didn't say that Israel died. I said that for me a certain component of the Israeli enthusiasm is dead. Yes, I think the essential Zionist ethos, the constructive element of Zionism, would be restored with peace. It is being deteriorated and corrupted by the lasting conflict. Same, by the way, applies to the Arabs. They are being degenerated by the prolongation of this conflict.
You once argued that there should be a wall built between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Yes, I said
was this metaphoric or...
No, I was very serious about this. I think for Israelis and Palestinians this is time not for a honeymoon but for a fair and decent divorce, which means building a temporary wall, dividing a very small flat, bedroom A, bedroom B, and certain arrangements over who is going to use the bathroom at what time.
And it is a very small flat, isn't it? That's the great shock.
Oh,
when you go to Israel, you find that it wasn't so much a country, it's more like an Australian suburb, isn't it?
If Israel goes back to the pre-67 war, even in the pretext of peace, you can drive across Israel from the ocean to the border in about 9 minutes.
Mm.
That's the breadth of the country right in the middle.
Does a wall... I mean, do you still hold to that view?
Yes. I think this wall ought to be a step one. Eventually, I can predict that Israelis and Palestinians will pop across the wall to have coffee together, eventually perhaps be able to laugh at their past follies, eventually knock down the wall and develop a common market, a confederation, something. But step one ought to be a partition, yes. We have had enough of each other's.
No wonder you get yourself into a bit of trouble over there, Amos.
You
are, in fact, faintly provocative, aren't you?
Well, I'm trying to retain a certain degree of integrity. I'm trying to be critical of the Israeli policy without necessarily falling in love with the PLO or the Palestinians.
Does it infuriate you that the left around the world doesn't fall in love with the PLO?
Yes, it does, because the attitudes of the left to the Mideast conflict are full of clichés, and in some cases they go as far as giving hypocrisy a bad name, if I may so say. You hear it very often from leftists in Europe and probably in this country. They will say to you in the same conversation, well, the Palestinians, you have to understand, they have suffered a lot. They have been humiliated and persecuted. It's only natural that they resort to some violence. The Jews, on the other hand, having been themselves the victims of oppression and persecution, how can they be violent?
Mm. Now, well, I must say, that latter part I've sometimes said myself. One expects a lot of the Jews. You're 1% of the human race. You've made You would have been more, of course, if it hadn't been for Holocaust.
We are far less than 1% of the human race. We are probably 0.1%
of the human race. I remember I calculated once. I remember it was terribly tiny. But the contribution, of course, has been enormous. Mm-hmm. And for many of the old left, the Jew was a symbol of liberalism and humanism.
I won't have the Jew as a symbol, because the Jew as a symbol means that the Jew is either subhuman or metahuman. He is neither. It is utterly wrong.
It's a very good
point.
Metahuman is almost as bad. It's probably
an inverted
form of
prejudice.
It's almost as anti-Semitic.
It's almost as prejudiced. I wouldn't take the point that the victim ought to be purified by suffering. Mm. Not the murderer, not the persecutor, but the victim. Very bluntly, let me say, I don't think the Nazi gas chambers showered their victims with moral cleansing liquid. Now, some victims, through persecution, become more sensitive, more receptive, and more understanding and sympathetic to the sufferings of others. Other victims of the same oppression become more vindictive, more suspicious, and more untrusting. And both responses to suffering are equally human. They may not be equally humane, but they are equally human.
Amos, because you bring a writer's sensibility to the issues, you make them... You're elusive. It's very hard for me to sort of put you on the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. And Israelis seem to have some of the same difficulties with you. Where do you place yourself? I mean, you're a peacenik, but you're in no sense a pacifist. We've established that. You're critical of your own, of the more sort of theologically repressive part of your own society, but you're more critical of the PLO. Where are you?
I'm trying to be in a reasonable man in an insane situation. It's not always easy. Reasonable and sane. You see, I've been regarded for a long time as the hawk of the doves. And to many Israeli left-wingers, I've been the hawk of the doves. That's probably where I am in some ways. You see, I have never believed, like so many leftists and peace-loving people, that peace and love and conciliation and compassion are synonymous. They are not. I am not in the business vis-à-vis the Palestinians. I am not in the business of make love, not war. If anything, I'm in the business of make peace, not love.
The right in Israel are just as impatient with you, though, as the left, aren't they?
Basically, yes. To them, I'm a traitor, more or less, because of the bottom line, because I do believe in a two-state solution and in the need to trade territories for peace and solid security guarantees.
Which territories would you be willing to trade if, by some happenstance, you were suddenly the Prime Minister?
Well, I won't go into the technical details of it. We have no map here and we cannot draw a quick map. But I'd say that the basic principle ought to be that the heavily populated Arab zones should be autonomous or independent. The heavily populated Jewish zones should be part of Israel. And the rest of the country, the empty, the deserts, should be negotiable. I don't regard any lines as sacred. Mm. It should be demographic, basically.
Has the Israeli left, the people that were taking a line that the PLO was a legitimate organisation and should be talked to, have they recovered from the shock of the PLO's instant enthusiasm for Saddam Hussein?
That's the irony. Myself being the hawk of the doves, the right-wing deviationist in the eyes of the left, Without moving an inch, I had become, after the Gulf War, a left-wing deviationist when some Israeli doves said, well, in this case, we are not going to talk to the PLO. Now, I never, never thought that this particular bride or bridegroom is a virgin. And as a result, after the Gulf War, I never came out of the bedroom screaming that the groom is not a virgin or the bride is not a virgin. Nonsense. I never placed much hopes in the PLO. And consequently, my position have not changed. But it came as a shock to the Israeli left. And the PLO has been stupid enough to put his money on each and every dying horse throughout history.
I know we haven't got the map here, but we both know where Jerusalem is. To what extent is Jerusalem negotiable?
Everything should be negotiable. By negotiable, I do not necessarily mean given away. I think the basic answer for Jerusalem is have Jerusalem administrated by half a dozen sub-municipalities with a high degree of autonomy. Half a dozen, not just two Jewish and Arab. Mm. There could be an Armenian one, there could be a Greek Orthodox one, there could be a Jewish ultra-Orthodox autonomy in the ultra-Orthodox section of Jewish ultra-Orthodox sections of Jerusalem. And let any Jerusalemite pick her or his passport at will. Now I've tried this solution on Palestinians and Israelis and Americans and others. Everybody equally hated the idea, which means it stands a chance.
You've argued that Israel owes the Palestinians one right only, the right to self-determination. Mm-hmm. What about the human rights issues? Because these must trouble you, and yet you have, in fact, copped a bit of criticism for not speaking out.
Well, I refuse to relate to the Israeli-Arab conflict as a human rightsist issue. Essentially, it's not. It's an international conflict. There is a human rightsist problem in Israel proper, but I don't see any chance of considerably improving it before the conflict is over. No nation had ever been very good on civil rights while at a deadly war with a deadly enemy. Mm. You have to get out of the conflict first and then deal with civil rights.
Tell the listeners about that, the story you were telling me before about the train trip from Oxford.
Well, technically speaking, Israel is still in a state of war with 20-something Muslim countries. One of them being Mauritania, which I couldn't locate on the map, I have to admit, shamefully. I once shared a train compartment with an African student who introduced himself as Mauritanian. We had a nice chat, and at the end of that journey, he said, "Isn't it marvelous that enemies can speak like that?" I said, "Enemies, what do you mean?" He said, "Don't you know, sir, that my country is at war with your country?" I said, "I'm sorry, I don't, and I'm afraid no Israeli is aware of this." Now, it turned out that Mauritania declared war on Israel sometime in 67. Nobody noticed. With them, it's the one and only secular national holiday. With us, it's insignificant. What an insult.
Yes, I feel a bit the same about Australia's involvement in the Gulf War. It was terribly important to us, but nobody else seemed to notice that we were there. But with all of this whirling around, with all these complications, with all these countries that want you dead, how do you feel about the Middle East conference this year? Do you see it as a piece of political window dressing or a piece of theatre or something bigger and better than that?
No, it's better than that. The moment Israelis and Arabs will negotiate directly, the cognitive block would be removed.
There's the cognitive block.
Cognitive block.
Yeah.
For many years, the Palestinians believed, the Arabs believed, that if only they rub their eyes hard enough, Israel will go like a nightmare, or perhaps like a mobile exhibition that can be taken elsewhere. The Israelis, for their part, for too many years, believed that the entire Palestinian issue is nothing but a vicious artificial invention of the pan-Arabic propaganda machine. Now both parties know that the other is there to stay. This is the cognitive block that is melting.
Right. Yeah.
With a lot of pain, sound and fury. People are screaming with pain like a patient awakening from a narcotic slumber. Screaming with pain to this realization. But this is the beginning of recovery. The other is real and the other is not going to go away.
You argue, of course, that Israel doesn't comprehend itself fully. It's got this problem of definition. Mm-hmm. This is explicable to an Australian because we struggle to resolve our own national identity such as it is. But it comes as a shock to me to hear you talk about this with Israel. But is that an impediment to negotiations in a sense? Does that make it more difficult for Israel to sit down and negotiate because it doesn't really comprehend its own nature?
Yes, it doesn't really comprehend its own nature, and consequently it cannot really conceive itself territorially. If the purpose of the Jewish state is to restore the kingdoms of David and Solomon, if the whole thing is a game of biblical restoration, then Israel cannot possibly give back the occupied territories under any terms. If the idea is to create a 20th century oriented or 21st century oriented society, then we can trade security for territory. So there is a certain mingling of our own identity problem and the conflict in the Middle East. But ironically, the Arabs have the same. There is no very distinct line between Palestinian identity, Arab identity, Muslim identity.
Sure.
What are you, sir? Are you a Palestinian first and an Arab second? Are you first and foremost a Muslim and then an Arab and then a Palestinian? What? Very parallel problem of identity, which doesn't make things easier.
One of the things that's going to complicate Israeli identity is, of course, the changing demographic patterns too, isn't it? That you are getting an ever larger non-Jewish minority, which at some point becomes the majority, doesn't it, on current extrapolations?
That depends on whether Israel is going to annex the occupied territories or not. With the huge present influx of Soviet Jewish immigrants, it's highly unlikely that the Jews will become a minority in the land of Israel. In no time, in 2 or 3 years, there'll be close to 5 million Jews in the country. That's a solid majority. But that doesn't solve the problem of identity, because the Soviet Jews have their own fantasies about what Israel should be. And those fantasies
What is the political and cultural impact of Soviet Jewry on...
I'm encouraged to say those immigrants, by and large, are secular to the bone. They couldn't care less about synagogue. What they dream about is a mini-America in Israel, and this part I do not necessarily like. You know, the middle-class fantasy. Red-tiled roofs and a carport and 2 family cars. That's a great dream. But they, paradoxically, with this dream, help to stabilize Israel and weaken the forces of the ultra-Orthodox and the fanatic. And in this respect, it's very encouraging.
And there's no sort of born-again Jewry taking place with these immigrants? I heard that there was, to some extent.
Well, not on any considerable scale that I can judge, of course.
So they'll help the secular balance?
I think so. It's helping it already.
See, both of us, we both live in countries where there's an... which are fantastically multicultural. Mm-hmm. Israel and Australia have that parallel, don't we? Mm-hmm. You know, yours are linked, at least by the Jewish idea. We have an ever-diminishing hub culture of the British. But we could be very interesting demonstrations for the rest of the world for the future.
I strongly believe that both Australia and Israel are a potential, at least a potential fertile ground for cultural renaissance, for tremendous prosperity. This juxtaposition of conflicting and contradicting tradition is rich. It doesn't provide for a cozy paradise, here or in Israel, but it provides for a perpetual stimulation for cultural creativity.
We cling to the coastal regions and the deserts over the shoulder. Mm-hmm. You live in the desert.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, the personal reasons are my son's asthma, yes, but beyond that...
But isn't there another reason with you?
Yes, deep down, I love the desert and I find it inspiring in a way which perhaps is too intimate for me to explain.
But you and T. Lawrence have that in common, do you?
Well, see, if I really explain to you what is it that I love about the desert, you'll start doubting my credentials as a secular Jew. And that would make your task even more complicated.
I meant to raise this at the outset. You are, in fact, often described as a very spiritual writer, despite the fact that
you're... I would say that I would not accept the definition of being secular. I have a tremendous fascination with theology and with the metaphysical dimension of human existence. I'm not a synagogue goer. I'm not a traditional Jew. I'm not directly interested in religion, and I have a strong feeling in me that God is not directly interested in religion, in any religion.
Now, that's one of the great lines. Say that again.
I said, I have the strong impression that God, like myself, is not particularly interested in religion.
I think it's a great line. Yeah. So do you find that, in a sense, the desert is... I know this is a corny thing, but do you find it in some way a metaphysical metaphor?
You know, I start my day, every normal day, with an early morning walk into the desert. And this helps me knock everything into proportion. Later on, at the 7 o'clock news in the morning, when this or that politician says forever and ever, or says never, or says for the rest of eternity, I know that the stones are laughing at this statement. It knocks everything into proportion.
You divide your time between fiction and also journalism. Your journalism is very politically committed. Why do you do the journalism, you know, because it helps augment your income from, although 22 countries translated, I guess the royalty checks are big enough.
I only do the journalism and the essayism for rage. I have never written a single journalistic line unless I had some fire in my bone. When I can't stand this or that, I write an angry article, and all my articles are angry. None of them is analytical, philosophical, or humorous. They might have a sense of humor about them, but they all originate from rage.
all.
And so my articles and essays, yeah. Not my stories.
Well, see, that's something that comes out of being, what, you're 51 years old, you've lived there all the time, you've never had a year off, as you have you as an Israeli, there's always been the pressure. So the rage comes from that?
The rage comes from perpetual measuring of the distance between the monumental initial Zionist dream or dreams, which I loved, and which still inspire me, and which I miss, and the realization that these dreams, by definition, cannot all come true. You know, the only way to keep a dream intact is never to try to fulfill it. Be it a sexual fantasy or a dream about a marriage or an intention to write a novel, if you really want to keep it whole and untouched and intact, never try to fulfill it. Now, Israel is a dream come true, and as such, it is flawed. I know it, and yet I rage over it.
Amos Oz, you're an extraordinary person, and you're here, of course, to promote the novel To Know a Woman, so we should plug that. Who is your publisher?
It's Chatto & Windus in England, and it's Random Century here.
Now, I've read here that you're a misogynist, but I can't believe that's true.
Mm-hmm. That I'm a what?
A misogynist.
Well, I've heard this word. I'm not even sure I understand what it means.
Well, we haven't got time to go into it anyway. Amos, thanks enormously for that. That's a very spirited segment in our program, and I hope you have a wonderful time in the land of Oz. Amos Oz.
Thank you for having me, Phil.